from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in the state of Mississippi. Childhood obesity is a problem in every state, but nowhere more so than in Mississippi, where 2 in 5 teenagers are overweight or obese. And the culture, as author Sarah Varney discovered, is shifting to accept that situation with dangerous results. My guest for this hour is Sarah Varney, the author of the new book called XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. Varney is a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She's been a frequent contributor to NPR and PBS, and she's on the line with us now from California. Sarah, how are you?
I'm well. Good morning.
Your phone sounds fine. We talked off air this morning about just making sure we have a secure connection. I know it's been a busy couple of days there. You're not that far from where the earthquake was.
No, we felt the earthquake in the middle of the night. I was actually hosting a sleepover for my son with my son and his friend, and the house started shaking around 3:20 in the morning, and it shook for quite a while.
Yeah, well, glad to hear that we've got a secure connection and that most folks are okay. We're still waiting to get a little bit more news, but thank you for taking the time. And again, the book's called XL Love. Now, problems related to obesity and sex start at a young age, a shockingly young age, at least to me, as I discovered in your book. Because in the book, you discuss the problem that obesity pushes children's bodies to physical maturity before they're really ready. You interviewed Dr. Carlton Gorton about a trend with young girls age 5 and 6 that I could barely believe, Sarah. Tell us about that.
Sure. So this is Dr. Gorton practices in the Mississippi Delta in a very poor town called Belzona. And one of the things that he mentioned to me was that, of course, he sees everybody. He's a family doctor, so he sees kids and adults and older folks. And he has kids who are 5 and 6 years old who are developing, girls who are developing pubic hair. They are being treated by an endocrinologist, a pediatric endocrinologist, and being given hormones in order to ward off the further development of puberty. But what we see is much earlier stages of pubertal development, very much so linked to overweight.
Okay, and so we're talking about kids. Again, the phrase was early onset puberty, right? I mean, that's not something that I'd ever even thought much about.
Exactly. And I also interviewed a pediatric endocrinologist in Jackson, Mississippi, at the big medical center there. And this is something that she's kept busy with, right? She gets referrals from all over the state. And she's particularly concerned with kids, particularly girls, who are developing at very early ages. Their bodies are really, in a sense, developing much faster than they can develop emotionally and behaviorally. So, you know, we know that there was a very large study that was done in 2013 of about 68,000 women, and girls who had early menarche, in this case, they were looking specifically at when they started their periods, had a much higher risk of unwanted sexual touching and of sexual abuse. So there's real concerns around these girls developing at very early ages, really before their minds and their emotions are really ready to handle that.
We're going to get into the way obesity affects adult relationships coming up here, but there is something that's kind of flipped on its head here. A lot of the time, and as you write in the book, when we think about obese adulthood, we think about, you know, I think maybe the assumptions would be less active sex lives, et cetera. And yet, when we think about kids who are obese, I mean, we don't want to think about the sexualization of children at all. But when we think about kids who are obese, you may just assume, well, you know, at least they wouldn't be going down some of those roads. Unfortunately, as you write, that's not the case at all here. Because, again, kids, earlier than they're ready, get their bodies start developing, and they become more sexualized and more likely to get into sexually risky behavior?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that and this is why it was so interesting going to Mississippi, but this is really happening all over the country. And I, in fact, interviewed many people in your region in New York, both marriage therapists, but also therapists who work with children. So, you know, parents who are sitting at home or listening to this who might have children who are overweight or obese, you know, these stories from Mississippi are not so far off, I guess, is what I was going to say. But what you find is that kids who are, particularly girls who are overweight or obese in particular, who do decide to have sex, engage in much riskier sexual behavior. So they are much more likely to have 3 or more sex partners. They're much more likely to not use birth control or condoms, and they're much more likely, if I can say, they're much more likely to engage in anal sex as well. And these are concerns a lot of therapists who work with these young children, because they're worried that these are the types of behaviors that these kids are learning. You know, I mean, during your teenage years, these are very important formative years, of course, for everything. But also, I mean, these young relationships, these sort of puppy love relationships, these early sexual experiences, these are all very important because they're cumulative. And we build upon them. And then by the time we're 18, 19, 20, we go off to college, or then we're out of college and we're in, you know, dating in our 20s and 30s, all of those previous experiences are incredibly important. So if you're spending your sort of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old years, you know, not developing healthy early sexual experiences, it can make it much more difficult for you as you get older.
All right. So in other words, as awkward as high school dating is or was for most of us, it's an important ritual.
Absolutely, it's an important ritual. I mean, this is when teenagers are, if you think about it, right, this is when you're starting to learn what can you expect in a relationship, what can you demand, and what can you expect from another person, what are you willing to give emotionally, physically, what do you expect of that in return. So this is really when you start to calibrate, you know, what kind of relationship do I want to be in, what constitutes a healthy relationship. And many of the researchers that I talk to who study this population, who study teenagers, they'll tell you that, you know, particularly for overweight girls, I had this one researcher say to me, you know, she, a guy comes up to her at a party, he gives her a little bit of attention, you know, she's more willing to perhaps do things with him because she wants to please him, because she's worried that perhaps she won't get another chance at doing this. And then she learns over time that this is sort of the way that she's going to get attention. This is what it takes to sense have a relationship, which I think is very worrisome. I mean, for those of us who are parents, I mean, that's not the kind of relationship any of us would want our children to be in.
No, exactly right. And that's why I thought it was gripping right from the start of the book, where you learn that kids who grow up obese, overweight early on, are likely to become sexualized. They don't have normal dating. They don't learn some of those boundaries. And then here's a line, I'm going to quote directly from the book. It now seems quite clear that the earlier a girl gains weight, the more likely she will get her period earlier and the more likely she will remain heavy throughout her life. You know, that doesn't mean that that can't change, but that's a very sobering thought, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that's interesting, is I think for parents who have kids who are overweight, or particularly parents who have kids who are obese, you know, this is obviously why pediatricians are very keen on this issue, because we know that the vast, vast majority of kids who are obese during their childhood years, during their adolescent years, will remain obese throughout their adulthood.
We talk about belly fat in a way that is almost cutesy, but the doctors you interviewed indicate that we're talking in a way that might even undermine the seriousness of it. And they wrote about all of the things that, you know, when we kind of cutely talk about belly fat, we tend to put aside. For example, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, adipose tissue?
Sure, yep.
What is adipose tissue?
Exactly. So there's different kinds of fat in the body. There's sort of subcutaneous fat that is fat that's below the skin that sits at the hips and the buttocks. And that fat is generally considered less dangerous than fat that's around the belly. So fat that's around the belly, and this is particularly worrisome for boys and men, that type of fat has an enzyme in it that actually converts testosterone into estrogen. So this is one of the reasons why across the board, it's very well established that overweight and obese men are much more likely to have low testosterone. So when we hear all these ads about low T on the television, many of those men have very significant belly fat. So there's a lot of concern among particularly pediatric endocrinologists when they see young boys who have very big bellies, not only because it is in a sense disrupting the sort of hormonal symphony that's occurring in their bodies, however turbulent and traumatic it may be for them. But also what we see, and this is one of the things that one of the pediatric endocrinologists mentioned in Mississippi, is boys developing breast tissue. So, you know, not just breast fat, which maybe if you were able to exercise and change your diet, that you could really get rid of, but actual breast tissue. And once the tissue is there, it's very difficult to get rid of it. And, you know, we know that being obese in adulthood for women brings with it a much higher risk of breast cancer. We don't really know, only because we haven't really had very many generations of so many young boys who are so big developing breast tissue. We don't really know what the implication will be for them as they get older.
My guest is author Sarah Varney. Her new book is XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. And you might have seen her or heard her not only as a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News, but a frequent contributor to NPR and PBS. Now, beyond children, we're going to talk about dating as adults and marriage as adults. I'm curious to know if you saw the clip that went viral from the television show Louie earlier this year. The main character, played by comedian Louis C.K., develops a friendship with a woman named Vanessa. She's overweight, and so, by the way, is Louis. But Louis is not interested in her beyond friendship. And in a May episode of the show Louie on FX, there was a scene that became known sort of virally as the fat girl monologue. Vanessa, the character, offers a long explanation how difficult it is to be overweight and dating. First of all, did you have a chance to see that, Sarah?
I have seen it, and it's fantastic, and I certainly had many friends email that to me, actually, as it went viral.
All right, so let's listen to a portion. We're not going to play all 8 minutes of it, but let's listen to a clip from that, and then we'll come back and talk to Sarah about it.
It just sucks. Oh, it really, really sucks. You have no idea. And the worst part is, I'm not even supposed to do this.
Do what?
Tell anyone how bad it sucks. Because it's too much for people. I mean, you can talk into the microphone and say you can't get a date, you're overweight, and it's adorable. But if I say it, they call the suicide hotline on me. I mean, can I just say it? I'm fat. It sucks to be a fat girl. Can people just let me say it? It sucks. And I'm going to go ahead and say it. It's your fault. Why do you hate us so much? What is it about the basics of human happiness? You know, feeling attractive, feeling loved, having guys chase after us. That's just not in the cards for us. Nope, not for us. How is that fair? And why am I supposed to just accept it?
You know, Vanessa, you're a very, really beautiful...
Come on. If I was a very, really beautiful, then you would have said yes when I asked you out. I mean, come on, Louie. Be honest here.
All right, that's a clip from Louis on FX with Louis C.K. talking to Vanessa. And Sarah, a lot to digest there. Let's start with just first general reaction.
I certainly heard many of, Vanessa's monologue, I think, struck a lot of people because it's what a lot of people feel. And it's partly why I wanted to write this book, because I felt like we haven't really, as a country, if you will, had this kind of conversation where we've just really come to terms with both for the individual, but also as a society, how obesity, now that it is so incredibly widespread, how it's, in a sense, not only, you know, it used to be obviously in the 60s, 70s, even the early 80s, where obesity, there were far fewer people who were obese, so there were far fewer people who were having that experience. Now it's the majority of people. And I was really interested in this question of, as obesity, in a sense, has spread throughout the United States, has the dating market, in a sense, changed to be more accepting of bigger bodies? And what I found was it hadn't. That the same kinds of survey results that you found in the 1970s and 80s, which found that people who were obese were the very last person on the list to be selected. I mean, they even had this one study where they showed a bunch of college students, I think it was six options. I might not get them all right now, but one was, you know, somebody who had a history of alcoholism, somebody who was missing an arm, somebody who had an STD, several others, and then somebody who was obese. And in every instance, the person who was obese was the last person selected for. And what's been fascinating and sad is that over the years, as obesity has increased, that the survey results continue to hold, which is very surprising.
Let's get to the phones in just a second. And if you want to join the conversation, it's toll-free to join the conversation no matter where you're listening from with Sarah Varney. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI right here in Rochester, 263-9994. We'd love to get your take on what you're hearing, thoughts on what you just heard on that clip there. And let's grab our first call. This is Rich in Rochester. Rich, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I think one of the major problems in this country is that we are this skinny society. Number one, we measure success on if you are fat enough, because being fat is a failure of the person. Number two, we won't face the fact that everybody cannot be skinny, because there is people who are genetically who are going to be heavier. And there are people, it doesn't matter what they do, they're not going to be skinny. And even if they lose weight, they're not going to look like the workout models that they use. And as long as this country starts looking at it like that, we're in huge trouble.
Sarah, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, there is something that's happening in the United States. This is not just bad genetics, right? I mean, there have always been people who have been overweight, and we know that. But when you look at the extraordinary rise of obesity in the United States, you can't just simply say that it's because there's just certain people who are slender and there are certain people who are bigger. So something is happening, and obviously many people have written about our food supply, many people have written about our sedentary lives. So it is not just simply that people are, you know, that all of a sudden our genetics have changed so quickly that people just we have. So
oh no, I'm not saying you can't. I'm not saying that that food does not play a role. Food does play a role, but don't forget, food is much more plentiful than what it was 60 or 70 years ago. So people are going to eat more, but even having said that, would you have people coming from all different parts of the world, and their genetics are different, and their evolutionary development as far as eating has been different? You even have people come from places like, say, Okinawa, who used to be the Shangri-La for long lifespan. And because Okinawans started eating our diet, which is huge and which is different, it's affected it. So, yeah, you're right that it does affect us, but there is still that thing that we take someone who's 135 pounds and they work out and they look even better now from 135 to 130 and say, yes, you can look like this person. And that's not always true, and we need to deal with that. And until you deal with that and you're honest, you're talking about one side of the conversation. You're talking about the diet, but you're not talking about the other part. And I think, honestly, I take offense to that when I hear these conversations.
Rich, I appreciate the call. And frankly, Sarah, I know you've heard this before, so go ahead. I'd like to hear your take on what he's saying there.
Well, I mean, all I would say is that what physicians would say the same thing, which is that we know that being overweight increases your risk for diabetes, for heart disease, for stroke, for breast cancer. There's a lot of reasons why you don't want to be obese. Now, that said, there's a wide range of what can be a healthy weight. I mean, we're not talking about needing to be slender, needing to be thin. You know, I'm certainly not talking about any specific. I mean, I'm a reporter, so all I wanted to do was sort of go out and find out what do people think about this issue, what's the social science, what's the medical research, and sort of bring it all together for folks to be able to read. So I think that the book, I mean, anybody would tell you that it's a very compassionate and very sympathetic to all of the things that people deal with in their lives. I mean, there were many overweight and obese people that I spent years talking to and got to know, went to church with them, hung out with their families. So I think anybody who reads the book would say this is incredibly sympathetic. So I'm not somebody over here who's sitting there saying, you know, oh, everybody needs to be slender, and if you do, in fact, your life will be great. Indeed, there's the last chapter of the book is actually all about weight loss and how actually difficult weight loss can be on marriages and on relationships, and that's oftentimes not the panacea. But I think certainly any physician would say, as difficult as it is, and as sort of, you know, all the cards are stacked against us with our food supply and the way our modern lives are constructed today, all of those things are true. I mean, I don't have any disagreement with that with the caller. There are still risk factors that there are still risks that are associated with being overweight and obese. And that each person, in a sense, has to decide for themselves how comfortable they are with those risk factors.
I think it what we're hearing is a bit of trying to find the proper middle ground between two very interesting sides in that, yeah, you know, there's been a lot of talk of, for example, the Dove campaigns and the ad campaigns and, you know, the Dove Real Women and, you know, not everybody is an airbrushed supermodel, et cetera. And so there's that campaign that take pride in however you look. And then there's a campaign that says, yeah, if you just look at the numbers, for some obesity or weight gain is very, very difficult to prevent. And for others of us, there's a bit of a choice element involved or a priority element involved. And I think that, I guess what I'm saying, Sarah, is when you report on this, when you write about this, I guess you have to be ready for some of that. It can be emotional for people.
Oh, it's incredibly emotional. I mean, absolutely. There were, you know, many, many of these interviews that I did with people. This was really the first time that they were really getting into, you know, many of these issues and willing to talk about them publicly. I mean, this book is about weight, which is incredibly difficult to talk about, and it's about intimacy, also something incredibly difficult to talk about. So, you know, a lot of the people in the book, you know, they very much trusted me with their stories, and I think that you would see that, you know, they're willing to tell their story. They're willing to sort of go out and say, this is, yeah, when I walk into a supermarket, people don't look at me. People look through me. You know, there's a lot of harm and a lot of damage that overweight and obese people feel every day as they walk through the world. And it really stinks for them. And it absolutely affects their self-confidence as they try and date or their relationship with their partner. I mean, it can be absolutely devastating. That said, every single person that I interviewed, I said, if we could wake up tomorrow and change the way you are treated by the world, would that repair everything? And not one person said yes, it would. They all said, you know, there's still a lot of other issues that I deal with about being big, about, you know, coming home at night and my knees are killing me, or I have to sleep every night with a CPAP machine, with a sleep apnea machine, or I have no energy, or as a man, I have very low testosterone, or as a very obese man, I have, you know, I have a buried penis. I mean, there are very real physiological and physical problems for a lot of folks that we generally don't talk about, and we like to simply say, oh, it's just a matter of, you know, if society were more accepting, then all of these problems would go away. And I think the reality is that would be fantastic if we could be much more accepting. Of course, I mean, obesity is probably one of the last remaining prejudices that people sort of throw around publicly. And I don't think anybody would condone that. Nobody would want to have a child who's obese or a friend or a partner who's obese who would be treated the way the world treats them today. That said, there are still some very real problems that folks deal with that don't just get written off when you can make that correction.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk about the story in one of the many interesting stories of the book between Larry and Dana. And Dana, for example, Sarah is talking about the way obese people feel, often invisible or ignored or not respected, and the prejudice against them. And then the way Dana felt when she felt after losing more than 100 pounds, all of a sudden people seemed to recognize her or see that she was in a room again. And that made me, Sarah, as a reader, beyond all of the other things that are important in this book, that made me as a reader basically say, I don't know that I'm doing it, but I've got to be cognizant not to have that bias against people because of their weight when they walk into a room. That do I want to listen? Do I want to have a conversation, etc.? And my fear is that bias exists in a lot of us, even if we don't recognize it. Dana's story helped me really see that, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, actually, I've heard that from a lot of readers so far of the book, that it made them much more aware of how larger people are treated in the world. And much more aware of their own actions. You know, what do I do when somebody? I mean, Dana even talks about when she was very big. You know, people wouldn't hold the door open for her. If she was at the supermarket and she had to reach up to grab something, nobody would sort of come in to help her. She would, in her own home, take the mirrors and put them. And this is very common. You hear this from a lot of people who are overweight, and you hear it from a lot of therapists who work with people who are overweight. They'll, you know, take a mirror and put it just sort of nose level and up so that they're only seeing their eyes when they're doing their eye makeup, for instance. People who, you know, don't take pictures of themselves, don't let any other people take pictures of themselves. So there's a way in which, you know, a lot of people who are heavy will go to many great lengths to not, in a sense, see themselves. And then when you talk to the therapists who work with them and the folks, and like Dana, for instance, they do talk about sort of a numbness that sets in, right? Like you're so, in a sense, kind of separated from yourself, from your physical body, that you, and there's sort of a numbness that sets in. And I think one of the things I got very interested in was, well, how does that then affect your ability to have a relationship with another person? And what you find in Dana's story is that it very much does.
Yeah, and let's do this. Let's take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back. We'll get more of your calls, because I know some folks are waiting to jump into the conversation here. Dana's story was a great example that weight loss doesn't instantly solve some of the problems and can actually create new complications. So there's a lot more to talk about here with author Sarah Varney. Her new book is called XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. Your calls and more with her next on Member Supported Public Radio. Coming up in our second hour, in the wake of Ferguson, we're examining police action. What's an appropriate response to potential danger? How often should police use military-style gear? Today we welcome two recently retired officers who can offer their perspective on what it's like in the most tense situations. And we'll welcome your thoughts on what you expect from your law enforcement departments. That's next hour on Connections.
Hi, it's David Greene from NPR's Morning Edition. On Tuesday, September 9th, I will be in Rochester with Planet Money's Robert Smith for NPR Presents Family Matters in partnership with the University of Rochester. Please join me and my guests in Hatch Recital Hall for an unconventional discussion about college, home ownership, retirement, and your financial lifetime. Space is limited, so please reserve your seat today at wxxi.org/events.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Sarah Varney is a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News, and she's been a frequent contributor to NPR and PBS. Her new book is called XL Love, and Jenna from Pittsford is on the line. Jenna, you're next. Thanks for calling.
I have a teenage son who is heavier. He's certainly diagnosed obese by his pediatrician. He's tall for his age. He's 5'6" and 13, but one of the things that we found is, as we examined his diet, my mom has worked for Weight Watchers for 35 years. His diet is no different than his brother's. We began to go down the medical trail trying to figure out what's going on. And we went to the endocrinology clinic at Strong. We were surprised to find out that obesity isn't covered by insurance plans. If that's the primary diagnosis, it's not covered. So we're stuck with thousands of dollars in bills. And, you know, one of the things that they're looking at is Cushing's disease as the cause of his obesity, but we can't get the testing covered by our insurance plans. And the emotional toll that it takes on him for his size is scary, and we're dealing with that. But that's a very real issue for families. And what we found out is it doesn't look like it's Cushing's, but he has no adrenal function at all. So as you're talking about the physical size and, you know, certainly penis size and development and all the puberty and all that kind of stuff, it's a very real issue for kids. But what do you do when you can't pay to find out what the answers are?
Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's actually, I did another story for NPR about a year or two ago where I went to Mississippi specifically because I was doing a story that was looking at the plans that were going to be sold on the exchanges, on the Obamacare exchanges, and the way that they were designed, it was to basically tee off of what was already being sold in the marketplaces in each state, or in the market in each state. And you're right that I think in about half of the states that obesity, weight loss treatments were not covered under, these were insurance plans in the individual insurance markets. I don't know if you have private insurance with your employer or you're buying a plan on the exchange.
I'm sorry, we have private insurance.
Private insurance,
self-insured plan through my husband's company. And so when you're looking at 2/3 of America have obesity, and yet whether it's private insurance or an exchange, if it's not covered, I'm not even looking at treatment. I'm just looking at trying to figure out what the cause is. We can't do it. It's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're not alone. I mean, I know that at least on the individual exchanges and individual insurance, that something like half of all states have not required weight loss or obesity coverage as well.
Very scary. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jenna. Thanks for the call. I think it just illustrates again another hurdle for parents trying to make sure their kids are you know, growing and moving through life in a healthy fashion. So I think that's another great point there. Sarah is the author of the book XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. And in that clip we played from Louie, she goes on, Vanessa, this character who's overweight on the show, Louie, goes on to say that, you know, Louie is also overweight, but he doesn't think that he should have to be with a bigger woman, that it's often bigger guys as long as they're with lesser-sized women. And Sarah, you write about this in your book. I'm trying to dig up exactly where it was. I think it was a study by Andrea Meltzer and Dr. James McNulty that touched on as long as men are bigger than their wives, one of the theories is that everything is good. That, you know, if a man is gaining weight, but or if a wife is gaining weight, but if the husband's gaining weight, then they'll essentially stay happy for a number of interesting dynamics. But you also warn that this is an oversimplification. It might not be the case.
Well, for social scientists who are looking at marriage and trying to understand who is, in a sense, quote, happiest in their marriages, the research for many years is really all over the map. So for a while, there was some research out there that looked that found that overweight women and obese women were happy and much happier when they were in marriages. In other studies, it was finding that, no, it was, quote, normal weight women were happier or normal weight men. And the research was really all over the map until they started really looking at the comparative weight between the husband and the wife. Now, again, we're talking about heterosexual marriages, and the book really very much focuses on heterosexual relationships only because there's very little research done into same-sex relationships. But what they found was that essentially, right, if the husband what mattered most was essentially that the husband just simply be heavier than the wife. And so it wasn't necessarily that the wife had to be slender or skinny. And what we know is that women very much overestimate how, in a sense, slender or thin they need to be. But it just simply mattered that they would be not as heavy as their husbands. So the relationships that you find are the most strained, at least when you look at the research, are the ones in which the wife is heavier than the husband. And those seem to be the relationships where there's much more arguments around food, there's a lot of arguments around dinner time, and the types of arguments researchers find are much meaner. You know, the comments go much closer to the bone, if you will, and those types of relationships just tend to be much more stressed.
But can you just assume then that, because a lot of couples will tell you, and you touch on this in the book as well, that after getting married, you know, couples tend to gain a little weight. That's sort of a normal thing. But can you just assume that as long as both spouses are gaining weight, even if it's a lot of weight, that everything will be fine?
Well, I think it depends on how much weight you're talking about. I mean, we do meet one character in the book who she and her husband were both very overweight. And many of the couples, I will say, that are in the book, with the exception of Dana and Larry, both husband and wife are considerably overweight, if not obese, or even morbidly obese. What I heard, at least from some of the folks that I talked to, was once one of the, if you've got a couple where both are morbidly obese, I mean, you're talking, you know, 400, 500 pounds, and one of them decides that they're going to really do something about it, it becomes very hard for that person to stay in that relationship if the other person isn't also willing to change their life. Because as much as we've talked about, you know, our food culture and our, other types of problems for why people become overweight, you really don't become that obese unless you've got most likely a pretty severe food addiction. Of course, there are going to be a few people here and there who are going to have kind of more like a biological cause of their obesity, but that's actually very rare. And so for a lot of people that you talk to who are that overweight, it becomes much more difficult for them to be in those relationships. They want to change what kind of food they have in the house. They want to change, how much they're exercising. They want to really change everything about their life. And it just becomes very hard for them to stay in that relationship.
You also write that in marriages where both spouses are overweight, even if they're not, again, morbidly obese, men especially may feel threatened if their wives lose a significant amount of weight. Why?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. Now, and again, anybody who's listening to this is going to say, well, that's not me, or that's not my friend, or I've got... And so these are studies, right? So these are, in some cases, population studies. So that means that we're looking at a very broad group of people, and there's always going to be some people who fall outside of this. But when you look at the research, this is sort of where there's the most this is where the most people kind of come in, right? So yes, what you find is that, and this was echoed by many of the people that I interviewed, and also weight loss therapists who work with both couples or marriage and family therapists who don't specifically specialize in weight, but they are working with couples who come to them. What they'll say is, oftentimes, you get married, it's sort of this ecosystem. The ecosystem depends on certain variables being in place. I, as a husband, I like the fact that my wife is a little overweight because it gives me a confidence that she's not going to leave me. And one of the really interesting stories, I think, is in the book is this woman on the Eastern Shore of Maryland who had just, she was quite overweight. And her husband was big as well, but certainly not as big as she was. She decides to have bariatric surgery, and the husband is very, concerned for her. And it brings back up this previous time in their life when she had gone in for lap band surgery. And he's somebody who, had never really written her a letter in his life, and not particularly communicative, lovely, lovely man. But he leaves her this letter before she goes into lap band surgery that says, "I'm worried that you're going to, lose all this weight, and then you're going to leave me." And so she really had to go back to him and reassure him to say, "No, I'm not, I'm doing this for me. I'm doing this to feel healthy. I'm doing this because, I have kids and I want to be able to keep up with them." But it really brings up a lot of insecurities in a lot of couples, particularly for men.
And in the story of Larry and Dana, Larry was actually, I thought, very sweet about his wife's obesity. He said it didn't stop his desire for her, but she would recoil from him. And you write that that situation is common.
Yeah, so for Dana, she's somebody who I got to know very well over the course of writing this book, and she was very, very open and honest with me. And yet when I went to go do other interviews or, talked to therapists or other people, this story was became very emblematic of kind of this larger narrative. And that's that idea that, if you are at war with yourself, if you're feeling, as Dana says, I felt like as I got bigger, I became a monster. That's how she's thinking about herself. So why on earth would anybody want her or want her physically? She thought she was, to quote her, that she was the unlovable fat girl. So despite the fact that Larry, and in many other instances in the book too, where you have these partners where the husband is saying, "No, I still find you, I find you attractive. I love you still." She just couldn't buy it. And so they would get into bed at night and she would put on her CPAP machine and she would roll over and that would be it. And Larry was very hurt by this over the years because it for him felt like a rejection.
And so she ends up losing a significant amount of weight. But as you write, and as we've talked about already, that doesn't instantly fix all of the issues. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. And so a lot of people who go through weight loss surgery, she actually had bariatric surgery. And so I spent quite a bit of time going to these bariatric surgery support groups. And in order to have the surgery in the first place, you have to have a psychological exam. But they really encourage you to, continue with a support group afterwards because the change is so incredibly dramatic. And it can really upend your relationships. In some cases, it's a great thing. In other cases, it can be a terrible thing. What happened with Dana and Larry was, here was Dana. She said really nobody really even noticed that she was losing weight until she had lost, 50, 60, 80 pounds. So finally here she is having lost more than 100 pounds or so. And she recalls this evening, they're sitting in their home and they're watching TV. And there's these photographs up on the wall. I've been there many times of her and Larry and the kids when she's really at her heaviest weight. So when you look around, she hasn't actually changed the photographs on the wall, which is kind of interesting because, as she said, I like those photographs of the kids. She's not really so much looking at herself. But anyhow, Larry is, Larry sees those photographs. So Dana's sitting there on the couch and Larry's in a chair. And she just turns to him and says, When are you going to start looking at me? When are you going to start desiring me again? And he just kind of has to do this double take, like, that part of our life had been dormant for so long that I didn't really realize that was back in play again, And so they really had to work at it. They went to therapy, both individual and couples counseling, to really start to think about, okay, how do we restart this part of our life that had really been dormant for many, many years?
And it is not uncommon for couples that thought they were happy to even end up in divorce after significant weight loss. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, you'll talk to these the counselors who work with, I mean, the, you know, they work with hundreds, thousands of these patients every year. So drawing off of their expertise is really interesting. And what they'll tell you is that, you know, a solid marriage can really make it through significant weight loss, but a marriage that was not great in the first place has a very difficult time making it through. People kind of wake up, you know, they look around and they say, who am I with? How am I being treated? There's a lot of women that I talked to who said, you know, I put up with a lot. I was sort of married to or with this guy who was kind of a jerk to me and did not treat me right. And now I have this self-confidence. I mean, you'd like to think that you could have the self-confidence regardless of the weight loss, but the reality here, at least what I found, is that with that weight loss did come this renewed self-confidence. And so they were looking around and saying, this isn't what I want anymore in my life. So there are very significant changes that come with weight loss.
If you want to join the conversation, it's toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI in Rochester. My guest is Sarah Varney, author of the new book, XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. Here is an email, comes from a female listener who says, Evan, please don't use my name. I'm going to try to condense a little of this. My brother and I are both significantly overweight. He's never had trouble dating. I've spent my whole life feeling ignored and irrelevant. She says, why do heavy men seem to have it so much easier, especially when you're single? Sarah?
Sure. So, I mean, what we know from the dating research is that it is true that heavier men don't pay as big of a price as heavy women, but they do pay a price. Interestingly enough, when you look at teenage boys, the teenage boys that actually have the hardest time getting the dates are really skinny ones. that starts to change as they get a little bit older. And when we move into the dating market in sort of 20s and 30s, we do know that heavy men do pay somewhat of a price. But it's absolutely true what the writer is saying, is that heavy women absolutely pay a price in dating. We know this. But what's really interesting is, you know, these social scientists for many years were trying to understand how does dating happen. But if you think about it from kind of a scientific perspective, how do you begin to look at that? You know, it's all happening sort of out there in the world. You can't really replicate it in the laboratory. So there were these early scientists who studied love and dating who in the early 60s put on this, if I can tell the story of what was called the computer dance. They put on this fake dance at the University of Minnesota. And what they did was they advertised it to freshmen saying, this is the 1960s, so the idea of a computer selecting your date, this was a very rare and kind of exotic thing, you know? So what happened was, as each person was coming up through the line several weeks before the dance to buy their ticket, what actually was happening was these sociology students who were older, who were selling them the tickets, were actually rating them in terms of their attractiveness. And the idea was to rate it very quickly, and the rating scale was very, you know, harsh. It was ugly, normal, or ugly, attractive, and average, I think were the three. What was interesting was that there was a lot of consistency with how the rating was done. Well, anyhow, so the computer had nothing to do with it. What ended up happening was the researchers just paired people off randomly, and the only thing that would kick out a pairing would be if the girl was taller than the boy, because that was still and remains to be still not something that was acceptable.
Right.
And then they went and they held this dance. And what they were looking for was what would essentially make people stay together or want to stay with their date. And the number one thing that they found was whether or not the other person had been rated as attractive. So that was sort of the first attempt at trying to understand this. But then the internet came around, and starting in the 2000s, researchers had this trove of data, and they would actually, and they still do, they cull data from Match.com and these other websites, and they can look at millions and millions of matches, and they can begin to, and then they have some of the characteristic data. So we know if you're a female, what age you are, we know how you, the identifiers, how you identify yourself, including weight. And so now researchers can really look at that data and see where do overweight, particularly women, kind of fall in that big mass sorting, if you will. And what you find is that they are still very much selected against. Even men and who are overweight themselves will disproportionately, you know, select against them.
So not a lot has changed in that regard, I guess. Sarah Varney, the book is called XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. When you are working as a health policy correspondent, you're seeing issues related to obesity in many ways. And as you've said, there's not a whole lot of conversation. You talk about obesity in many ways, but not often about intimacy. But why, what was the main goal of putting this book together? What was the driving mission? What did you want to come out of this process with?
Well, I think for me, as you mentioned, you know, as a health policy reporter, I spent a lot of time doing stories about diabetes and obesity and all sorts of things. But I felt like we weren't really talking about people who are overweight or obese as full people, as full human beings. And obviously a big part of that is the kinds of relationships that we have in our lives. So I got very interested in this question of, well, what, how else, you know, I think in general we can sort of say, oh, it's hard to be a bigger person and to date, or I'm heavier and that's harder on me. But really, what do we know? I mean, what is the social science telling us? What is the medical research telling us? And what are kind of individual interviews and reporting telling us? So my hope is that I think this is an issue that people really want to talk about. I mean, what I found in doing these interviews is that people would say, thank you so much for asking these questions. The only questions anybody ever asked me is, you know, what's your weight and what's your waist circumference and what's your BMI? You know, all of these sort of measurements. But nobody's really ever asked me, like, well, what's it like for you? And I think that was the biggest thing for me, was to allow folks to their voices to be heard, and to hopefully kind of draw other people out to be able to have a much more nuanced conversation about weight than we've had before.
For me, we've talked on this program about the over-sexualization of children and how many parents are concerned about that, but I had never connected it to childhood obesity. And again, if you're just joining us, the book really begins with a look at the way childhood obesity leads to, almost forces children's bodies to develop physically earlier than they're ready for it. And that leads to immature sexual behavior, risky sexual behavior. And then it leads to a lack of a real and sort of formative dating experience. So absolutely enlightening in so many ways. Who would you say the book is written for? I mean, I think any one of us can gain and learn by reading it. But what's kind of a target audience here, Sarah?
Well, I would love for people who are overweight or obese themselves to be reading the book and to hopefully see something in it for themselves. I think that they would find that the book is incredibly sympathetic and compassionate, but that also really sort of helps them see that there are other people out there who are having the same experience, and how did they work through it. I mean, it's certainly not a self-help book by any stretch of imagination, but I think there is power in reading other people's stories and knowing that you're not alone, and also looking up at the social science and the medical research and really understanding what is the full implication here. And I hope that we as a country sort of, you know, there's been so much work done on obesity, and I think unfortunately, our public conversation about it has been stunted, because it starts to feel a little bit like either you're a, quote, fat activist or you're fat shaming. And I think that there's a lot of ground in between those two things. And that's really what I was trying to do in the book.
And when it comes to marriages, for me, one of the big takeaways is a great reminder of the vital nature of communication. I mean, you look at Larry and Dana and you admire so much of what they're doing, but, you know, Larry was even saying he couldn't read her cues when she lost weight, and she was confused about why he wasn't reading her cues, and she didn't even know that he'd kind of given up on intimacy. These things just aren't talked about, and I know they're difficult to talk about, but I think your book reminds us that good communication can save a marriage.
Yeah, interesting enough, one of the marriage therapists that's actually up in your area, he says weight is one of the most difficult things for people in a marriage to talk to. So he'll have people come in, they'll talk about, you know, married couples come in, they'll talk about the children, they'll talk about finances, they'll talk about sex even, but bringing up weight is really the most difficult thing that couples can talk
about. Harder than money.
Feels so personal, exactly. So then now you combine the two things, you know, you combine weight and you combine intimacy, and it's really difficult work. And I applaud any couple that goes and actually gets, you know, seeks out counseling or group therapy to be able to talk about these issues, because it is very, very difficult stuff.
A friend of mine, Sarah, said, he said, hey, I you know, can't get together when you wanted to get together. My wife and I have a counseling session. And my quick reaction that a lot of people do is, oh, man, I hope everything's okay. And his point was, no, we're great. Sometimes we just want to go get counseling to make sure we're sort of proactive about that. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have this one of the people who worked on the book with me. She's an adolescent psychologist. She was a researcher. She likes to talk about, you know, mental health tune-ups, you know, going in to see a therapist, just as you would, you know, your annual exam.
Sarah Varney's book is called XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. It's out now, available now. You're going to hear her work as a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News on many places. You've probably seen her on PBS or heard her on NPR, and we're thrilled to have you on the program today. Thank you for taking the time to join us and to really dig into a very, very interesting book that I should let our listeners know. We've sort of barely scratched the surface up, too. So, Sarah, there's a lot more there. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, short break now. Coming back next hour right here on member-supported public radio with a look at police, the so-called militarization of America's police. Is that a hyperbole? And what should we expect of our law enforcement? That's next.